Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is also available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, they are available on Spotify. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. Hope you got to see some good movies in the last week. And we'll get to my list as well as your list. You can grab a pencil in an hour. And I'll explain because earlier this week, well, the day before recording, I had an exactly one-hour conversation with Austin Titchener, who is the artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company and the co-author of many of the Abridge, Complete Works of Shakespeare, Abridge scripts. Fun stuff. Because, if you don't know, and now you do, William Shakespeare's long-lost first play is on the road in Indiana as a part of Indie Bard Fest. And you can see it 7 o'clock September 12th at the Needhammer Green Space. That's 2104 East Washington Street in Indianapolis. Bring your own lawn chairs for that show. They're going to be outdoors at the Fringe Theater on September 19th. That's 719 East St. Clair Street in Indianapolis. September 26th at the Junk Ditch Playhouse in Fort Wayne. That's 4018 Covington Road, Fort Wayne. And October 3rd at Civic Park in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, 111 East High Street in Lawrenceburg. So you can go to IndieBardFest.com for all the information on that. I got to see it at the beginning of its tour. It is a lot of fun. And I got to talk to Austin Titchener about Reduced Shakespeare, abridged scripts of Shakespeare movies, and all sorts of fun stuff. So strap it down, get ready for an hour of witty banter, especially on Austin's part, and enjoy. Austin, what was your first Shakespeare experience?
Well, I think my first Shakespeare experience was the same as most people's, through Star Trek. I grew up with the original series in the 60s and then the extensive reruns in the 70s, and I was just starstruck about how many times this guy Shakespeare appeared in Star Trek, either as a reference or an historical figure brought back to life. Maybe that was on Bewitched. Maybe I'm confusing you. And how many times he was quoted, and how many lines of his were used as episode titles. Then, of course, you get to Star Trek VI, the film, and they say that classic line about how you can't understand Shakespeare until you've read him in the original Klingon. Those are two passions of mine, Star Trek and Shakespeare. And you can't spell Shatner without Shakespeare either, when you can. But not, you get the point. You understand the point of it. But anyway, that was my first. But then, thankfully, my first real experience with Shakespeare, as he should be, experience was on the stage. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and would go to American Conservatory Theater, and I saw productions there of Othello and Julius Caesar, Macbeth, and The Taming of the Shrew, and I just was dazzled. So by the time we got to reading here in high school, I had already seen him, and so though it didn't make any sense to me on the page, I knew that it could make sense coming out of the mouths of people who understood how to speak him. And so even then, and I was a theater nerd already by that point anyway, even then, when assigned to read Shakespeare in English class, I would read him out loud to myself. I would say the words out loud because they make more sense coming out of my face than they do passing across my eyes, and I do that now when I'm reading it, and as a you know, grown up and a guy who's had some experience with it. I mean, it just makes more sense when you hear him spoken.
Yep. Did you have the English class with the 9 records of Gielgud doing Hamlet in English class?
Thankfully, no, and I don't know why. That seems to be a ritual that missed me. I don't know why.
It's really okay. It's funny you mentioned Shatner, because the first show I ever directed was one I had written about the character actor who wants to be a leading man. I called it Yearning for Dogberry, and I opened the show with the audio of Shatner doing To Be or Not to Be for about a minute, which is more than enough.
Oh God, yeah. I met William Shatner once. I was on an episode of Boston Legal, and all of my scenes were with James Spader. But I had to share an elevator for 45 seconds with the great Mr. Shatner himself, and so I was able to exchange, hello, how are you, with him, and that was the extent of our exchange. But it occurred to me I would have loved to tell him how much his performance as Captain Kirk meant to me. But I knew enough about his prickly behavior that I thought, if I do say that to him, the Shat would have hit this fan. I didn't want to experience that.
Well, it's a shame you weren't 20 years younger and female.
Well, indeed. I suppose I could have dazzled him by telling him how much his performance as T.J. Hooker impressed me, but that seemed unnecessary.
Well, he had the great turning point when he was on Saturday Night Live and did the convention sketch and told everybody to get a life.
Well, I really do think that he once he began to own his iconic status and begin to make fun of it, that's when I think he turned an important corner. And that's it's a great journey for a guy who started as a serious, in air quotes, Shakespeare thespian up at the Stratford Festival in Canada, where he was understudying Christopher Plummer.
Yep. Who, up until everything went kablooey, I believe Mr. Plummer was still doing stuff up in Stratford.
I think you're right.
So before Reduce Shakespeare, what Shakespeare had you done as an actor?
Oh, well, as an actor, I had played Claudius a couple of times. I played Claudius in a production of Hamlet when I was in grad school. I then played Claudius in a summer stock production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. But honestly, that was the most Shakespeare I'd ever done. I somehow got through high school and college theater programs without doing any Shakespeare. But my very first assignment in grad school, I got my MFA in directing, and my very first assignment was to take a Shakespeare play and direct it in 5 minutes. Tell the story of the Shakespeare play in 5 minutes. So I was reducing Shakespeare before I even joined the Reduced Shakespeare Company. And over the years, we've continued to reduce them. I mean, the reason we're talking is because they're doing William Shakespeare's long lost first play, Abridged, this weekend outdoors. It is one of the reasons we keep reducing him is that really almost every production you see is in some way an adaptation of Shakespeare, because people cut it for time, or they cut subplots that don't emphasize the story that the director wants to tell. They cut old jokes that don't make any sense. They cut classical allusions that our audiences don't understand anymore. And so unless you're doing an uncut production like they do at the Globe in London, or sometimes they do at the RSC in Stratford-upon-Avon, almost everybody's doing an adaptation of Shakespeare when they produce him, and I'm not sure that's as well understood as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm reducing Shakespeare, I'm doing it with a sort of vaudevillian intent to celebrate him irreverently, to treat him with reverent irreverence. But honestly, I'm really not doing something that isn't being done by quote unquote real Shakespeare companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, my wife and I did a summer theater camp for 10 years, 10 summers, and the last four for middle schoolers. We would do Shakespeare, and we would combine actual text with, you know, silly nonsense to move the story along, and so the kids don't get overwhelmed with a lot of the language. And it was a great bridge builder. And by the way, I think the Reduced Shakespeare Company is a great bridge builder between Shakespeare and folks and their fear of Shakespeare.
Well, thank you. I hope that's what we are able to do. I mean, it's why we've returned to our Shakespearean roots in our last two shows, the Long Lost Shakes, but also the show we wrote afterwards, which we were in the midst of doing a large national tour and talking about taking it to England when the shutdown happened. Our most recent show is Hamlet's Big Adventure, a prequel. which is the story of the characters of Hamlet taking you right up to just before the beginning of Shakespeare's tragedy. And, of course, what we have written is the comedy of the Prince of Denmark. But I hope that we have answered a lot of questions that you come out of Hamlet thinking, asking yourself. So this will explain that. I hope we're a bridge. I hope so. I mean, I've directed, you know, again, quote-unquote real Shakespeare for quote-unquote real companies. And for instance, I directed Twelfth Night at Cincinnati Shakespeare just a couple of balls ago, autumns ago. And I was having this conversation because they had figures, statistics to show that fully 35 to 40% of their audience is new ticket buyers, people who have never been to the theater before.
Mm-hmm.
And my biggest fear is boring a newcomer to theater and a newcomer to Shakespeare. I would rather upset a quote-unquote traditionalist or a purist, Shakespeare purist, about who sniffs that Shakespeare must be done in a certain way.
Right.
I'd rather piss off those people than bore or turn off somebody who could really embrace Shakespeare if it were showed to him in the correct way.
That's I'm with you on that. I was part of we have a Richmond Shakespeare Festival in the eastern part of the state, and I was in a production of Titus Andronicus, and I was Saturninus, and it was done like the horror film motif, and we have a local horror show host down here named Sammy Terry. And I got to record him doing the curtain speech, and he had never seen the gentleman had never seen Shakespeare before and saw it and said, I've now ruined it because it has to be as bloody and as gory as that. And I said, well, maybe Macbeth and maybe Richard III, but that's, yeah, it's hard to top this.
I love it. Yeah, Romeo and Juliet. Rest in peace.
Yeah, we did all that. How did the Reduced Shakespeare Company come about?
The RSC official history, we are coming up on our 40th anniversary in 2021, was the RSC, Reduced Shakespeare Company, was started by a man named Daniel Singer, who in the summer of 1981 was a Renaissance fair geek in Northern California. And they have the Ren fairs back then, and maybe they still do, had sort of opportunities for performances, outdoor performances in amongst the attractions of the fair. And these slots were about 20 minutes each. People could get up and perform or sing or juggle or do whatever they wanted to do. And Daniel thought, we should do something called the Reduced Shakespeare Company. We would be the other RSC, not the Royal, but the Reduced. And there'd only be a handful of them. And we would do short versions of Hamlet, based, inspired very strongly by Dog's Hamlet by Tom Stoppard. And so he cast five people, and one by one, two or three of the original cast members fell away. But Jess Winfield was part of it, and then when they lost the woman in the company, they said, oh, well, we're going to have to cancel the performance because Barbara can't do the show. And Jess said, well, I've got a friend who's been to every performance and knows every line. And Daniel said, great, what's her name? And Jed said, well, that's the thing. We're going to need a wig. And that's when Adam Long joined the Revue Shakespeare Company. And then Adam Jesse Daniel became what are regarded as the original three members, founding members of the Revue Shakespeare Company. And so they did a 20-minute version of Hamlet that summer. 2 summers later, they did a 20-minute version of Romeo and Juliet. They did that for a bunch of years. And then until somebody said, well, you know what? You should do all of Shakespeare's plays and take them to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. You've done two. There's only 35 more. How tough could that be? And so they constructed the complete works of William Shakespeare Bridge, took it to Edinburgh in the summer of 1987, thinking that would be the swan song of the company, because none of them set out to be professional actors. They all had different interests and things. And yet that became the launching pad for the RSC, because they started getting interest from places all over the world to come to visiting theater festivals, et cetera. And so Daniel left the company in 1989 when he got an opportunity to become an Imagineer for Disney, something he'd always wanted to do. They suggested bringing in a man named Reed Martin, who Jess and Reed knew each other from the UC Berkeley Drama Department. And then when Jess left the company in 92, both Jess and Reed thought of me, who was also in the UC Berkeley Drama Department. And so because I wore glasses, I could play the smart one. And so then Adam Long, Reed Martin, and I were the RSC from 1992 till about 2001. And we wrote I came along right around the time that the guys were thinking, oh, well, we really need to do something else because people think we're a one-trick pony. It's a pretty good trick doing mm-hmm. the complete works in 2 hours. But what else can we do? And we thought, well, what can we write that will get us more popular in America? What do Americans take as seriously as the British take Shakespeare? And we thought, oh, well, themselves. So we wrote The Complete History of America, abridged. That got us to perform at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., which got us onto National Public Radio frequently. And then that made us more well-known in this country. So, and then the Kennedy Center asked, well, this is great. What else have you got? And we said, well, we've done Shakespeare and politics. What else can't you talk about? Religion. We want to reduce the Bible. Old Testament, first act, New Testament, second act, and when we take it to Israel, it'll just be a one act. And this is shows you how different a time this was. This is in 1995. The Kennedy Center went, that sounds great. You write it, and we'll produce it next summer. And we did. So we premiered it at the Kennedy Center in 96. And then from there, we have gone on to abridge other things. He turned all the 1,000 years of world history into a musical, called it the Complete Millennium Musical Abridged. Every book you should have read in high school but probably didn't, All the Great Books Abridged, Completely Hollywood Abridged, The Complete World of Sports Abridged, which we performed for the summer of 2012 in London during the Olympics. And then the Ultimate Christmas Show Abridged, which is every Christmas celebration and story. Every December holiday celebration and story crammed into one evening. The only Christmas show you'll ever need to see. And then we did The Complete History of Comedy Abridged, which is really the show we've been training all of our lives to write. and then returned to our Shakespeare roots with Long Lost Shakes and Hamlet's Big Adventure. So.
So you're, in a way, it's like the stage version of Mystery Science Theater as far as riffing and reducing.
Well, it really is. And people, you know, we used to get this question a lot. Do people get upset with what you're doing? And not usually. I mean, there are people who think you shouldn't make fun of the Bible, but they're never coming to the theater anyway. So screw them. And also, what we're doing is celebrating these things.
Yep.
This is how we honor and show love to the things we love. I've been married to my wife for over 30 years, and I make fun of her every day. I'm not going to make fun of Shakespeare or the Bible or history or literature. Of course I am. These are irreverent celebrations of the subject matter, and I think most people who come to the theater appreciate that context.
Yes, and she must be a patience of Job. I call my wife.
No, God, no. I wish.
Oh,
no, in fact, she gives as good as she gets because my wife D. Ryan is a former Second City improviser and sketch writer. So, she is. There's a much give and take in our house.
So we're going to be doing reduced Virginia Woolf anytime soon.
We've talked about it.
It's a lot of drinking and yelling.
We could do it, but it'd be a busman's holiday, really. We'd have to memorize lines. It's more fun to just improvise our own.
Nice. All right. So for those who know that it's in town, the William Shakespeare's long lost first play. Give us the origin of the story.
The origin of long lost Shakes is we were taking a tour of the vaults of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., and which has the largest collection of Shakespeareana and the largest collection of Shakespeare actual folios and quartos in the world. And we performed at the Folger Theater, which is part of the library, back in the early 90s, and we stayed in touch with them. And so when we were performing in D.C. that time, and I think it was 2010, we said, can we get a tour of the vault that the public can't see? We went down there, beautiful stuff, handsome. We got to touch I touched a folio, and I liked it. and it was just – so it was a privilege to be down there. And because I do my weekly podcast and have been since 2006, I took my recording equipment down there, and we recorded our tour. And my wife was with us, in fact, and she asked the question, if you were doing a sort of a National Treasure Da Vinci Code movie about Shakespeare, what would the treasure be? And they said, an original manuscript in Shakespeare's own hand. And all sorts of light bulbs went off, like Las Vegas went off over my head, thinking, well, we're never going to find one. Let's write it. What would that be? And I took that idea back to Reed, and Reed said, yeah, it would be 100 hours long, so we would have to reduce it. And I went, yeah, and it would be his first play that when he was still a genius, yes, but not a craftsman, so he was still a kid trying to figure out what to do with all these great characters and ideas and plot lines and poetry and language. And so it quickly became his long lost first play became first draft of Shakespeare, it containing every plot, every famous character, and first draft versions of some of his most famous iconic lines, all crammed into this one single story. So in a way, it's sort of greatest hit, Shakespeare's greatest hit, crammed into this. And in another way, it's like you were talking about earlier, it's a bridge to Shakespeare. It's an introduction to Shakespeare. And what became so wonderful is that people come to see Long Lost Shakes and complete works too, and Hamlet, and a lot of them come out of it going, I know more Shakespeare than I think I know. And I think that's a huge discovery for so many people. Shakespeare is so much a part of our DNA. We know him better than we think we know him because we know his storylines. Just talking to a friend of mine who's a professor at Notre Dame, and he was saying, asking his students, when did you know that Romeo and Juliet were going to die? Before you read it, as you read it, and none of them could identify that moment. It wasn't from reading it or seeing the movie. They just knew. They just knew that Romeo and Juliet is a doomed star-crossed love affair. Because he's just there. He's all around us. Maybe it's because they saw Romeo and Juliet.
Or the one with was it Norma Shearer and Leslie Howard? Romeo and Juliet in their 40s and 50s.
Oldio and Juliet.
and I got to see this. I got to see the Bardfest production, and watching it reminded me a little bit of Shakespeare in Love, where these little nuggets, that's from this and that's from that, kind of pop up. And it's another one where, you don't have to be an expert to still enjoy the show. And as you say, that has a familiar ring to it, or that's where that line comes from. It's a fun romp.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. I'm really hoping to get down there and see it this weekend. It's not that long of a drive, but I am chasing a writing deadline, so we'll see. But I'm crossing my fingers I can get there.
When you see your work done by other groups, what do a lot of groups get right, and what do they not get right?
Well, the thing they get right is choosing to do my fact. So they're clearly people of exquisite taste. The thing that they typically get wrong when they're doing one of our reduced Shakespeare Company scripts is they don't treat it seriously enough. And by that I mean, the old adage is that when you're playing a drama, you have to play it very seriously. Mm-hmm. And when you're playing a comedy, you need to play it very seriously. And what we find sometimes is that we'll go see a production done by an amateur group or even a professional group where they'll feel like, they'll get nervous. And they go, Jesus, there hasn't been a laugh for 20 seconds. We've got to do something stupid, which undercuts the seriousness of what the characters in the play are trying to do. And it's only funny if these characters are so desperate to accomplish reducing something within the 2-hour time span that they're making crazy, outlandish decisions. There are also times like when I'll go to a website for a company that's doing one of our scripts, and they'll say, running time, 2 hours and 20 minutes. And I'll go, whoa, you're doing it way wrong. It should be no longer than 1 hour and 45 minutes with an intermission.
Nice. What is the writing room like when you all collaborate?
Well, the very first writing room that we had was when we were all sitting around a table in London in 1992, trying to write the complete history of America abridged around a table. And we quickly realized that we were arguing over definite articles and prepositions. We were arguing about the wording of things. We were arguing about the trees instead of trying to figure out what sort of forest we wanted to make. So we quickly figured out that we need to have separate writing rooms. And what we do is we go away. We talk and confer. It used to be in person, then it was via email, and now it's on Zoom. Fingers crossed we're going to be able to do it back in person one of these days. But we talk about generally what do we think. And now Reed Martin and I are the co-artistic directors of the Shakespeare Company, and we write all of our shows. And we will confer about what we think it should be. We'll confer like on a general shape, and then we'll just go away and just email or text each other ideas. What if this? What if that? Or here's a line that absolutely needs to be in here. And is that a scene, or is that just a joke? And is that, or if it's a joke, is it the setup, or is it a punchline? Does it come at the beginning? Does it come at the end? And then we just write scenes. And now we have something to respond to. Now we have something to talk about. And once we get it into a shape that we're relatively happy with, or whether we think we've gone as far as we can and now we need some outside eyes, then we will show it to some of our trusted, friends and colleagues to say, what do you think? We usually do a reading for people, again, very in-house, and people will laugh or not laugh, and then they'll have questions about, well, this, based on something you said here, I thought you were going to go here, but you went here, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes that's not good. Are we satisfying the expectations of a title? When we do, like, Completely Hollywood Abridged or All the Great Books Abridged, we ask our friends, well, what would you say is the greatest book ever written? What's your top 10? What did you study? What were you forced to study in school? These are the sorts of things we should cover. When we were writing The Complete History of America Abridged, we did way too much research, and I was a history major at Cal, so I was the most guilty of this. And we did all this research and ended up writing sketches about the Lend-Lease program or the vibrant presidency of Millard Fillmore, and you can't make jokes about things that the audience has no idea what you're talking about. So we went back to basically an elementary school textbook to cover the hotspots, the highlights of American history, which is all that we get taught anyway. So it's really about finding something that makes us laugh. And also covering the subject matter in a way that seems satisfying to both us and to the audience, and also picking a subject for reduction that is interesting enough that we want to spend several years, if not decades, of our life reducing.
So I guess there won't be a reduced version of The Art of the Deal.
Oh, God. No, no. Well, the reduced version of that would be to flush it down something it won't clog. But, yeah, no, I mean, that's the other thing, too. It's hard to make jokes about a joke.
Right.
And the more serious, I mean, that particular guy has created a very not funny and very serious situation in our country. And there's, it's worth taking the piss out of that. But sometimes, as the British say, but sometimes you don't want to spend any more time on a certain topic and you want to turn to other topics.
Like what I'm going to do right now. What Shakespeare play is the hardest as far as drawing either material or inspiration?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's harder to make jokes about the plays that aren't as popular as some of the others. To say it another way, it's more easy to make jokes about Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet. I mean, there's a reason we didn't write Troilus and Cressida's big adventure, you know, because nobody knows that play. And it's got some lovely features, but it's not a great play. So that's the hardest thing is making jokes about things that audiences don't recognize. The other hard thing, too, is, you know, a lot of our, you know, when we wrote The Complete History of Comedy Abridged, in many ways, that was our most challenging show to write. Because all of our shows are, in a sense, subtextually already the complete history of comedy. Because we are bringing in every form of comedy we can think of that has been used throughout the centuries, from the pratfall to the pun, to highbrow comedy to lowbrow, to physical pie fights to classical illusions and elevated wit, everything. So when that is your subtext, how do you then make that your text? And so for The Complete History of Comedy, that was a particular challenge. What was the original question?
I would say, which plays were hardest to draw inspiration or ideas from?
Oh, I guess the ones that we didn't.
Yes.
I guess it's the answer to that.
That's all right. Shifting gears a little bit, do you have, because this is a film show, do you have a favorite film versions of Shakespeare's plays?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I've been watching a lot of them in lockdown. I think ultimately my most favorite is that documentary they made called Shakespeare in Love. it's so wonderful, and it's, you know, probably not at all how things ended up, but as far as I'm concerned, it should be. It's just a wonderful Valentine to not just Shakespeare, but to theater generally. I just had the privilege of seeing, it was part of the NT Live series, I think, the Adrian Lester, Rory Kinnear version of Othello.
Ooh.
Done by the National Theater. And that's an incredibly powerful and sort of brilliant, not fancy, but just straight ahead, smart, powerful a production of that play. I think Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet is terrific. I think it's a great introduction. Whatever awards he won or was nominated for, best direction were really for most direction, which I don't have a problem with. Because I think the visuals in that tell the story as much as the text, maybe even more so than the text. And I think that's a great, high energy, fun interpretation.
My wife and I saw that when we were dating, and we were the two oldest people in the theater. And at the very least, it got a lot of butts in the seats. The 90s, when it came to film, Shakespeare in film was a strong decade, and that one really brought a lot of young people in and introduced them to his work.
It really did. And in fact, you talk about the 90s, there's two adaptations that came out in the 90s of Shakespeare plays that are terrific. 10 Things I Hate About You,
yep,
which is a setting Taming of the Shrew in high school, and She's the Man,
yep,
starring Amanda Bynes and a very young Channing Tatum,
yep.
Channing Tatum, which sets a 12th night in a sort of prep high school. And those are both great adaptations and very fun and very true to the spirit of Shakespeare. I was trying to figure out the best version of Hamlet, and I'm not sure I have a favorite. The Mel Gibson Hamlet is really strong. I just don't like Mel Gibson that much. Directed by Franco Zeffirelli.
Yep.
Kenneth Branagh's film is 4 hours long. And,
yes, it is.
And creatively cast, to put it mildly. But it really emphasizes the scale of the politics and the political conflict that Denmark was going through at the time, which is a flavor of the play that you don't get typically in stage productions. I do like the film of Midsummer Night's Dream with Kevin Klein.
Yeah,
Bottom. I really like that one. One of my favorite. I'm a big fan of the Hollow Crown series.
Yes,
miniseries that was done for the BBC and PBS, and it's basically Shakespeare given the Game of Thrones treatment. and it's terrific. Not all of them are outstanding. Like I think there are better Richard III's out there than Benedict Cumberbatch's. In fact, Ian McKellen's film version of Richard III is terrific. But I think Ben Whishaw as Richard II in The Hollow Crown is sort of definitive. I think that's really. Sophie Okonedo playing Margaret in the trilogy of the Henry VI plays is extraordinary. But one of my favorite Shakespeare films is not an adaptation of one of his plays. It's from 1941, I think, 1942. It's the Jack Benny Carol Lombard film To Be or Not To Be.
Yep, yep.
About a Polish Shakespeare troupe during World War II. Where they shut down the theaters because the Nazis have invaded Poland. It was filmed during World War II,
mm-hmm.
when the Nazis had invaded Poland. And it's a Valentine to Shakespeare specifically in theater generally, and it's charming and funny and powerful in its way. And the fact that they were making this in the teeth of Nazi aggression is extraordinary to me.
Yep, wide pants for having large stones to pull that off.
Indeed, yes.
I got to play Falstaff last year, and
good for you,
man. It was a nice surprise. Five years prior, I got to play Benedict. That was my first Shakespeare play, and I never thought I'd play that role in a million years. And then Glenn gave me the shot to play Falstaff, which apparently became one of the big no-brainers. But watching The Hollow Crown and watching Chimes of Midnight, it's one of the few times I don't like the biopics that say name of actor is name of character. However, Orson Welles was Falstaff.
He really was. I wish I liked the movie better, but I love the idea of it, and he is absolutely. He's sort of a common image of our Falstaff. That when we think of Falstaff, we're sort of thinking of him.
Yeah, a kind of a demented Santa Claus. But yeah, the film is Falstaff's greatest hits. It is Orson Welles, so of course it's all about him.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course it is. Yeah, it gets me angry that he wasn't. He didn't play the movie making game better, so he could have made a better film.
Right.
You know, made in pieces over many years, and it looks it. But yeah, congratulations. That's terrific. I've directed Much Ado twice, and I love it. And I maybe can play Dogberry in the future someday. But, you know, one of the fun things of this lockdown has been the rise of, I guess, the online Shakespeare projects. And one of the strongest of them is a thing called The Show Must Go Online. It's created by a guy named Rob Miles and his a creative partner, Sarah Peachy, in England. And they have been doing, since March, online Zoom productions with a global, diverse cast of every single Shakespeare play in order, in the order in which we think they were written, one a week since March. They are two-thirds of the way through the canon now. They will probably finish by November. And they're extraordinary deep dives. They're not as edited as much as I would like, but of course I'm the reduced guy. but they are incredible deep dives for people. Like if I was assigned in school to read and write about a Shakespeare play, I would absolutely go to the Show Must Go Online version of it, and they'll be on YouTube now and forever, and read the script in hand while they're saying it, because they are incredibly well thought out and incredibly well performed, given all the limitations of being on Zoom and being isolated and lag time because of bad bandwidth. They're extraordinary, and I bring that up only to say, I was reading Troilus and Cressida, you know, as you do, about
yes.
2 months ago. And I'd never read it before, honestly. You know, a dark secret. Don't tell anybody.
Right.
This is public radio, right? Nobody's listening.
Wow, thank you.
So I'm reading it, and I tweeted, I'm reading Lord of the Crescent, and I'll say this. I'd love to play Pandarus, the old, lecherous, you know, horrible person, but charming rogue in his way.
Yep.
And Rob Miles, the creator of The Show Must Go Online, tweeted back at me saying, noted. And then 3 weeks later, he says, so do you really want to play Pandarus in Troilus and Cressida? And I went, yes, please. So I got to play Pandarus.
Hey.
What I hope is just the first time, because really doing it whetted my whistle for doing it again, quote, for real, unquote, someday.
That's cool. After the first year of the Richmond Shakespeare Festival, we have a group of players and fans, and there's a bookstore in Richmond called The Two Sisters, and we would go every Sunday and read one of the plays. And so we went through the entire catalog, and I think I only missed maybe three or four, but it was one of the best experiences as far as finally sitting down, reading it, hearing it. You know, how often does an opportunity like that come about? So I think that's great that you're able to see that work performed.
It really is great. And honestly, the reason I was reading Troilus and Cressida is that I'm in a Shakespeare book club, because of course I am, with an old friend and her husband and her PhD in Shakespeare from Harvard daughter and her husband. So it's basically, it's two practitioners, two civilians, and two academics, and we meet once a month to talk about the Shakespeare play we've just read. And it's again, fascinating to get those three perspectives. You know, when I read a Shakespeare play, I'm reading it to see how I would make it work.
Right.
Or see how it can work on stage. And so it's interesting to also get the response from a person who just enjoys Shakespeare and doesn't know anything about him except that she loves it, and to hear what she thinks, because every night so often my friend Lynn will say something and I'll go, oh my god, that's something that's so fundamentally true about this play and I never would have thought about it in a million years. You know, it's great. I don't care where the good ideas come from, I'll steal them from anybody.
So what is the next meeting?
The next meeting is, let's see, we just did Measure for Measure. So whatever's after, oh, it's Othello. Gosh, it's Othello.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, so that's a toe-tapping good time.
One of my favorite possessions is I have a DVD of William Marshall doing Othello with Ron Moody as Iago. So yes, you have Fagin and Blackula in the same production, and it's great.
I love it. I love it. And I knew William Marshall played Blackula because I know that. he also played an admiral in an episode of Star Trek.
Yes,
and we brought it full circle.
Yes, we did. and yeah, I'm the guy who owns both Blackula films on Blu-ray. These are your pledge dollars at work. going back a little bit, I guess all, besides the Shakespeare films, Shakespeare films or non-Shakespeare films, what films have you been watching recently since we've had time?
That's interesting. I've been finding that I'm on a quarantine apocalypse jam. So I've been watching sort of from the beginning, things like the original The Poseidon Adventure, the Andromeda Strain.
Yep.
I had never seen Contagion when it came out, and it's really good and horrifyingly prescient.
Yep.
I did see Outbreak when it came out, and I thought it was stupid then. I watched it again. It's even stupider now. you know, we want a whole bunch of things. I watched the Cornetto trilogy, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. We want to watch, we haven't gotten to it yet. We want to watch The End of the World. What's the End of the World with Seth Rogen and James Franco?
Yes.
Whatever.
This is the End.
I forget what it's called.
This is the End.
This is the End. That's what it is.
Yep.
This is the End. Yeah, so I also read Station 11, Emily St. John something. I can't think of her last name. Mandel. Emily St. John Mandel wrote Station 11, which is about an apocalypse and from the point of view of a woman who's part of a touring Shakespeare troupe
in
the dystopian future. It's a lovely novel, and even more so now. I find it comforting. I know people who are staying away from anything related to apocalypse and quarantine, but I find it comforting to see how these our situations are interpreted by artists and creative people and how we respond to it. I've also been working on a play that I've been thinking about for years. I actually started writing it two summers ago, my writing deadline. This is the deadline I'm chasing. And it has taken on new urgency because we're in lockdown, because I can finish it. But it's also taken on new meaning because we're in lockdown and because, we're experiencing not just a sort of a governmental failure, but societal breakdown and social justice protests and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, which I enthusiastically 100% support and think it's way overdue. It's been, I'm trying to respond creatively to my situation and still write comedy, because I do think comedy has a place. And in fact, I think when I see productions of Shakespeare, the comedies are insufficiently serious in production, and Shakespeare's tragedies and histories are insufficiently comic in production. So what was great about Shakespeare is that he was able to blur so many tonal lines. He was such a great humanist, they say that Shakespeare shows us our humanity in all of his plays, and yes, that's a great thing for a bumper sticker, but what it really means is that he was a humanist that showed the foibles of every kind of person on the planet, be they nobility or a mechanical, rude mechanical, from a royal to a fool. And I think too many productions of Shakespeare make it just one thing. This is a history. This is a tragedy. No, it's all of his plays are all of those things.
I had a friend who once said, and he tells students, when in doubt, fart on Shakespeare.
Fart on him.
Well, that costs extra, I think. But no, I think there was one rehearsal I was able to do. It was right when Falstaff is caught in his lie, and I turned and broke. And it broke everything down. And then my director said, "You couldn't do that every night, could you?" And I said, "No, that's a bad move, literally."
It is that's a really bad move too.
Yeah,
because you can't. That's really hard to think. If it genuinely happens, I've seen way too many productions of that where people are pretending to laugh because they're pretending like it's really. Stop, please, stop.
But no, you're right about you have to have elements of comedy in your tragedies and vice versa, because it is an ebb and flow, and you need that in a way, release. And yeah, keep, like you said, keep it less stodgy, I guess.
Well, and also Shakespeare loved contrast. And he knew he was enough of a showman. Like, if you're putting together a playlist, you want a slow song and a fast song, right? You know, you don't want it to be all slow songs or all fast songs. And Shakespeare was a master playlist maker. He knew how to shape a script and shape a story to take us from the tragic to the comic. You can't have glory without pain, and vice versa. You know, there can't be a tragic fall unless there's a great rise to start on. You know, it seems just basic to me, but I don't know why more people don't understand that. Harumph.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Blazing Saddles reference for the win.
Oh, always, whenever possible. So, Austin, please plug your podcast, since you're on a podcast.
I will. I shall. Yeah, it's the creatively named Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. And the entire coming up on 14-year archive is available at my website, reducedshakespeare.com. It started as a basically a DVD bonus feature for our fans, because we had just finished performing in London for 10 years, and we weren't going to be touring in England for the next couple of years. And this was back in 2006. And we thought, well, how can we keep ourselves sort of alive to our fans around the world? And the podcast seemed a really obvious idea. And once I figured out how to make it manageable and producible, no matter where I was in the world, then I went, oh, okay, this will be fun. And it has turned into a thing that I wish somebody would pay me to do, because it's really some of the most fun I have every week. It's talking about the work that the Reduced Shakespeare Company does behind the scenes, but then it's also me interviewing artists and actors and comedians and writers and directors and graphic artists and designers and academics and stand-ups and musicians and composers around the world, talking about how they do what they do. And each episode is only about 20 minutes long. A couple of the highlights have been I got to interview Brian Dennehy.
Ooh.
Great actor Brian Dennehy, who we lost during this pandemic tragically.
Yeah.
I interviewed him backstage before a performance of his 5-hour production at the Goodman Theater of The Iceman Cometh. He was willing to take a half an hour to talk with me about Eugene O'Neill, about how much he loved Eugene O'Neill. From Brian Dennehy to Weird Al Yankovic, who invited me into his home and talked with me about the work that he does. And, you know, and I had always considered Weird Al a sort of a boyhood hero. And then I found out he's roughly my age. And I'm going, well, wait, how does that work? And he's such a nice guy, one of the nicest guys in showbiz. And also just recently during this pandemic, I did a massive sort of two-part episode of the podcast with Lawrence O'Donnell, the host of The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC, one of our most important, or at least valuable, voices on air now about what's going on in our political world. But also 20 years ago, a writer and performer on The West Wing, and the creator of a short-lived TV show called Mr. Sterling, which was basically Josh Brolin goes to the Senate, and starred Josh Brolin and Audra McDonald, and they only shot 10 episodes, and I was on 3 of them.
Wow!
And so I was able to contact him via Twitter and say, you know, since the West Wing Weekly podcast didn't dive deep enough, as far as I'm concerned, into Mr. Sterling, would you come on to my podcast and talk about Mr. Sterling? And it was great because, you know, Lawrence is, in addition to being an invaluable political voice, he's a creative person as well. And he wrote this show 20 years ago about a functioning government, which is essentially science fiction now. So it was fun to talk to him about even the possibility of doing it now, but also what it was like to do it then. It was just a great behind the scenes conversation about a show that I thought, you know, should have lasted longer because it was also it shot in a studio that was like a 15-minute bike ride from my house. So it was great. It was a great gig when I lived in L.A. But that's what the podcast has afforded me, allowed me to do. It's just talk to fascinating individuals, record the conversation, and share it with my fans. It's only 20 minutes long. Most podcasts out there are way too long.
Thanks.
They don't invest enough money in editors. Probably like this conversation most people
No, it's fine.
But anyway, mine is only 20 minutes long, and it's at reduceshakespeare.com or wherever you get your podcast.
Well, I didn't mention. I'm telling you, but during the quarantine, my daughter, who like she's 18, she just finished The West Wing, and just fell in love with the show, big time.
Yep.
And
yeah. It's a classic. I've mentioned it myself several times. Did she particularly like episodes 12 in the first season?
I will check in with her after my rehearsal tonight. So yes, I will bring that up with a slight hint as well in the tone in my voice. So
yeah, she needs to rewatch that and be appropriately dazzled.
Yep, and then I got to see Brian Dennehy do "Death of a Salesman" at the Goodman back in the 90s, and I'm hoping he was in a good mood when you talk to him. He just seems like, you know, not one to trifle with.
Yeah, you don't want to mess with her. Well, I knew him briefly, slightly, because one of his daughters is a very good friend of ours. And so I saw him in London doing Death of a Salesman with his daughter and son-in-law. And then he took us all out to dinner at the Ivy afterwards and just held forth and told stories. And I was able to do that a couple of times. It's just be wined and dined by Brian Dennehy when having the whole fork. I made him laugh several times during my podcast, and I thought, oh, thank God I made Brian laugh. Okay, all right. I lived the podcast another day.
Nice. Did you see the latest film version of The Seagull?
No, I did not.
Look for it, because he's in it. Saoirse Ronan, Annette Bening, Mare Whittingham, Elizabeth Moss. There's similarities as far as doing Chekhov in film like Shakespeare. This one, it moves. It's I think it's like under an hour and 40 minutes. Really good actors, tells the story, doesn't have that kind of BBC or, you know, Masterpiece Theater vibe to it where it's 3 hours long, and it's quite good.
Well, that is how I like my Chekhov and my Shakespeare.
There you go. All right, I got two more questions, and then I'll let you get back to your procrastination. And thank you for letting us be a part of your procrastination and your deadline.
Listen, procrastinating is the essential part of being a writer.
There you go.
Great to see you.
So, going to your IMDb page, which hospital was more fun to work on, ER or Chicago Hope?
both fun in their way. Noah Wiley is taller than he looks because he was acting with Anthony Edwards and George Clooney, both of whom are tall, and Eric LaSalle, all of whom are taller than he is. He's 6 feet and he looks like a short guy, a little bit like Steve Kerr when you see him away from the rest of the Bulls. Oh my God, he's over 6 feet. That was just one quick scene, but it was a great homophobic jerk to play. That was sort of my niche on television.
It's on your card.
Racist, sexist, homophobic jerks. I only occasionally got to play nice guys. My mother used to say, they never let you smile. I'm going, Mom, the checks are clearing. I'll say whatever lines they want me to say. Chicago Hope was a really fun hospital because I got to fire Mandy Patinkin and he got to yell at me. And it was really great. And he gets, of course, a million takes because he's got a million ways to do this long ranting speech. And I'm sitting off camera trying to feed him my lines. And I thought I heard something that sounded like my cue. and so I said, Jeffrey, that was his character's name, Jeffrey Geiger. I said, Jeffrey, and he turns at me and he says, you shut up. Which is an ad lib. He was literally yelling at me to shut up. And then that got him off his track and train of thought. And he went, tried to go back to his speech, and he went, "Give me that again. I'm sorry for yelling." And I gave him the line again, and he went on. And then at the end of the evening, it was also his last night of shooting Chicago Hope. So there was cake, and it was 2 a.m. by the time we got out of there. At the end of the evening, he said he apologized again, and I said, "Please don't leave us. You're in the moment." He said, "It was a real pleasure looking in your eyes." And I thought, what a wonderful thing for an actor to say to another. It was so great looking in your eyes, because that's what we do. They were both fun hospitals.
Okay.
Not like the one in Tootsie where Bill Murray says that is one laddie.
There you go. Do you have any stories involving Gillian Anderson or Don Johnson?
No, I don't. And it's not because I said it in such a way that it implied that I did, and I don't want to tell them. But no, I don't.
Okay.
My scenes on Nash Bridges were with Cheech Marin, and I wish I'd had a podcast then, boy, because I'd have just interviewed Cheech Marin for hours.
Yep.
Because he's so good and such a nice guy. I guess my story about Don Johnson is that I only had a couple of days work, but they paid me for an entire week. Up, and I got to go up to San Francisco, which is where I was born. But they paid me for an entire week because I was going to shoot on both a Friday and a Monday, because Don apparently doesn't work Mondays and sometimes phones in and says on a Friday, "Yeah, I'm not coming in." So we're sort of at permanent standby. You know, am I working today? Don't know yet. Yes, you are working. Come on down. So that's my story there. And my Gillian Anderson story is, I had, again, one scene on The X-Files, and I was there, again, until 2 in the morning. I went in at noon. I was there until 2 in the morning because it was the episode where they were filming David Duchovny's last episode. Mm. So it was the end of the third to last season or the beginning of the second to last season, something.
Yep.
And so they were filming Mulder and Scully's final scene together until they made a movie. And so it was hard to get through. So they were crying and laughing, and it was just took them forever. So they just kept telling me, "Stay in your trailer. Yeah, we're not ready for you yet. No, we're not. No, it's going to be a while." So I don't even think we started shooting my stuff until after midnight. And I didn't get to work with Robert Patrick either, even though I had just played his wife's TV husband in an episode of a cop show on Lifetime that I can't even remember the title.
No, that was actually the title, A Cop Show on Lifetime.
That's maybe that could well be it, yeah. You'll see it. You're looking at the IMDb page. You'll figure it out.
I know. So, all right, Austin, thank you so, so much for your time, and thank you for your work, man. It's been a thrill.
Well, it's been lovely chatting with you about me. Why wouldn't I? I really hope I get to come down because I can't wait to see. First of all, I'm so thrilled that somebody's doing my play.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, I'm glad that people are out doing and going to theater again, and I hope everybody's keeping their distance and keeping their masks on.
Yep. Good luck with the deadline.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
That's Austin Titchener, artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, podcast host, co-author of Bridge Scripts, and a fun guy. And I have to say, this conversation, as you heard, it takes up 3 of his podcast episodes, not 5. Math is a skill, as I learned on Twitter talking with Austin. So anyway, just a reminder that Indie Bard Fest and their production of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, is happening at Niedheimer Green Space on September 12th, the Indie Fringe Theater on September 19th, the Junk Ditch Playhouse in Fort Wayne on September 26th, and at Civic Park in Lawrenceburg on October 3rd. While we're in the shameless plugging department, we also have at the Cat Theater, October 2nd through the 4th and 9th through the 11th, a radio version of Neil Simon's Plaza Suite. That is happening up at the Cat. You can go to thecattheater.com for all the information on that. Full disclosure, yours truly is directing that that shindig. So there you go. Okay. Going back to what I've watched over the last week, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. So last week, I revisited a couple of several titles, actually, and I'll get to those in a moment. But new in theaters and new on video this week, there's a film that's out by IFC Midnight called Rent-A-Pal. And it's set in 1990. We have poor David, who's 40 years old, lives in the basement of his mother's house. She has dementia. Father's committed suicide. He's having trouble with the videotape dating service, because it's 1990. And while he is looking for a new mate and visits the corporate office as far as getting information and tapes on people, thank God I'm married and have not had to deal with video dating services. Online dating is another thing. I've heard good stories about that. But anyway, David finds a videotape in the used bin called Rent-A-Pal and puts it in. And it's basically one of those, it's like a found footage videotape series. I know there's a couple of festivals where they just show, my God, this was made into a video cassette. And this one is Your Friend, and it's Andy. And in the film, Andy is played by Will Wheaton, and we'll get to Will's performance in a moment. And as David is trying to come up with a life and trying to find the perfect mate, and also having to just live at home with his mother while they live on disability, he becomes obsessed with the Rent-A-Pal videotape. So watching this, you see David as with immediately out of the gate, you see him with the parted hair, the 80s glasses, the kind of chubby. He, a cynical person would say, well, he looks like a serial killer. That's not the story, although as time goes on, it kind of does. I have to give kudos to Brian Landon Fulkins, who plays David, because early on, you are really rooting for this guy trying to find the right girl. He is flawed, but not out of the gate creepy. There's a great moment where it's a slight turn, but not that big a turn. As I mentioned, his father's committed suicide, and this is one of these guys that as he's watching the Rent-A-Pal video, the Will Wheaton character of Andy will talk and he'll leave pause for you to respond. And David starts to do that quite a bit with the videotape. In fact, they become the best of friends in a unnatural kind of way. But as a moment early on after David's had a few too many drinks and you see him thinking about his family, thinking about his father, and he staggers in to put up an old movie screen, and I think it's a 16-millimeter tape or 16-millimeter film, and what you think is family footage is actually an old-fashioned stag film. So there's flaws in his character, but the film doesn't really get into horror with the capital H show mode until the last 15 minutes. And but watching him deep dive is somebody who you could sympathize with, even though as it goes on, it's going to take a dark turn. There is a match that eventually does show up. There is a moment of – it's funny because my wife watched the Netflix film. I forget what it's called, but it where the man sues the computer dating service. And I got to see a 90s version of that. The moment where he gets a voicemail from the office. David gets a voicemail and that a match has occurred. And he runs to the office, but he forgets his wallet. And he runs home, grabs the wallet. And by the time he returns back to the office, the match that was listed for him has gone on to somebody else. So there's that moment where it addresses, is it truly a matchmaking company, and or is it just a racket? And so it does address that a little bit. But there's some lovely scenes with David and his date. There's also a moment of jealousy. The thing that I liked about the film is where it is vague, at least it is for me. You're not sure if all of this is in David's head, or do we have a videotape that manipulates people? If you're a fan of The Ring or Ringu, it could go that way. And I don't think the film addresses that, and I'm okay with that. So anyway, I like this film more than I thought I would, and it's like I said, the last about 90 minutes, it does take a turn into kind of killer mode, but it didn't sour the first 90 minutes as I was watching this poor guy trying to find a friend, trying to find a soulmate, whether it's in human or in videotape form. So IFC Midnight Rent-A-Pal, well done, like that. Also on also out this week, courtesy of Amazon Studios, is a documentary, All In, The Fight for Democracy. And it talks about the history of voter suppression in the United States. And it goes all around the election of involving Stacey Abrams, who tried to be the first African-American governor, running for the governor position in Georgia. And that voter suppression was a spotlight in that election. It's obviously the slant in this film is making sure your vote counts. And some people will have a problem with that, apparently, if you, 'cause the documentary does have a point of view. But that's really not a surprise to anybody in 2020 when it comes to a lot of documentaries. Not all. But we go back and forth between what Stacey Abrams' election went through and her story, along with the history of elections. Of course, never forget, at one point, white men who owned property were the only ones who were allowed to vote. And according to the film, in 1789, when Washington was elected, only 6% of the population voted. So we get a lot of the stuff I knew, so this history lesson, the cinematic history lesson, will probably enlighten a lot of folks where what is happening with what happened with the 13th through the 15th Amendments, the 19th Amendment, the Mississippi suppression of the black vote, Florida's and the voter suppression of felons, the civil rights movement in Selma, having to have David Rehnquist in Arizona in the suppression of Latinos and Native Americans. So it goes through that, goes through the gerrymandering, goes through the voter ID laws, goes through the Ohio purge and Georgia getting rid of polling places. So it should be informative, and it'll probably put a fire in your belly if you haven't already. So for me, a lot of I already knew this, but there's a few moments like the Ohio purge and the polling places in Georgia disappearing. So I did get some new material, but yeah, it's out there on Amazon Studios. I recommend it if you want to get angry. And of course, I've said this before about a lot of documentaries or a film like JFK, even if the film makes you go and do research to see if the film is wrong, I think the film does its job. So that is out on Amazon Studios, All In, The Fight for Democracy. Going back to what I was watching for fun, last week I revisited it was from 2018, if I remember right, the film version of Anton Chekhov's The Seagull. There have been a number of films in the last few years where you take a familiar story and you're able to make it lighter or to no disrespect to Masterpiece Theater, but to scrape some of the Masterpiece Theater, PBS, BBC aspects of it off. The personal history of David Copperfield, as we reviewed a couple weeks ago, is a great example of that. The last film version of Emma is an example of that. And this version of The Seagull, Chekhov is really hard to capture on film and to be exciting. Even if you have a great cast, because there's a lot of people in nice suit, in nice clothes, eating and drinking on the grass and not going to Moscow, as we jokingly say in the Soci household. This film version of The Seagull with Saoirse Ronan, Annette Bening, Brian Dennehy, Elizabeth Moss, Mare Winningham, it tells the story. It's under an hour 40, if I remember correctly, and it moves. It's not a stuffy costume drama, costume comedy. It's really one of the better, if not the best film version of a Chekhov play I've seen. So I revisited that. because of my buddy Eric, who we'll get to his list of what he watched recently. He had revisited the Louis Malle film Atlantic City, which I unabashedly love, love, love. And it's one of my favorite crime dramas. Burt Lancaster, Susan Sarandon. He's an aging mobster, low level, still running numbers, still kind of a manservant for the widow of a known gangster, played by the fine Canadian actress Kate Reid. Susan Sarandon is trying to build her way up in the casino world as a card dealer, but her husband left her and got her sister pregnant. And so there's a combination of that, and he's taken a drug deal that was not his and tries to sell it on his own. What I love about, especially the two performances from Lancaster and Sarandon, both of them received nominations for it. This was a Best Picture nomination. I'm still waiting for Criterion to give a treatment to this film. Lancaster had already by 1980 been one of cinema's great tough guys. And you sort of see that early on. But as the film goes on, we find out his character wasn't that big of a deal. And to see him repress from not really puffing his chest, but having the history behind him to showing his age, showing his vulnerability, and not to give away a 40-year-old film ending, but almost turning into a little kid when he finally has to step up and protect somebody, in this case, Sarandon. And this was Sarandon's first Academy Award nomination. She had been, throughout the 70s, kind of an ingenue damsel in distress, although the first time she worked with Louis Malle 2 years prior, she played a prostitute, a madam, who is... can't remember if she was running the brothel or not, but in Louis Malle's Pretty Baby with Keith Carradine and her stage screen daughter played by young Brooke Shields in a controversial take. But in this one, she's not the damsel in distress, and she's not quite the film noir femme fatale. There's something in between, and the two really, really work well together. And I geek out on Atlantic City because I spent a lot of summers in Atlantic City. My dad's side of the family is from New Jersey. So I got to witness the transition from arcade, Navy pier games to the casinos, from pinball to video games, to how it became, it tried to be the Vegas of the East and the economic divide that happened toward that. I found it odd that looking back now that I grew up in Flint, Michigan, which also had its economic divide. And then for my vacation, I went to Atlantic City. So anyway, I love the Louis Malle film Atlantic City. I hope more people check it out if you can find it. But now that Local Hero has been given the Criterion treatment and another video company put out Tender Mercies, I think the top of my wish list for Criterion is to do a two-disc collection of Louis Malle's Atlantic City. Because Kate Reid was in Atlantic City and she was in this other film that I have on Blu-ray and not watched yet. Well, I've seen it before, but not the Blu-ray copy I had purchased. And because it was Labor Day, I had my daughter watch the 1985 television version of Death of a Salesman. Happy Labor Day, gang. Dustin Hoffman, John Malkovich, Charles Durning, Kate Reid, of course, plays Linda. A play, I saw it when it was on TV. I was fans of Malkovich and Hoffman, of course, as a teenager. I had already heard about Malkovich's reputation as an actor on stage, but he had already done Crimes of the Heart, or Places in the Heart, sorry, Places in the Heart, The Killing Fields, and then this. And it was my introduction to Arthur Miller as a 15-year-old knucklehead, and I was blown away. In fact, my freshman year of college, I got to play the waiter in Muncie Civic's production. So it's resonated with me. My daughter, not so much. She lasted until the last final confrontation between Willie and Biff. It happens. But anyway, I got to revisit it. And I forgot that the director of The Tin Drum directed this. So the realism of the characters in the story, backed up by a real fantasy set. It was a really cool contrast. So anyway, I watched those. New on something old and something new, courtesy of Film Movement Classic, the 1993 Italian film Caro Diario, also known as Dear Diary. And it's a story in three chapters with the same guy, the filmmaker, kind of playing himself. Chapter one is a lot of him riding on a Vespa with the camera behind him. A lot of this. And he talks to people at random. It reminded me a little bit of David Thewlis in Naked, although not nearly as confrontational. Obsessed with Flashdance. The film also has a Jennifer Beals cameo, which I still don't know how that happened. The also a guy who watches Henry Porter of a Serial Killer. Also, there's a fantasy moment where the filmmaker rereads reviews written by film critics and makes them cry. It's a bit self-indulgent there. In my notes, I wrote about chapter one, 30 minutes in, and I'm already tired. Chapter two, same guy goes to an island to work on his screenplay with a lot of meandering and not writing. I actually probably would have preferred writing than a lot of dealing with American tourists, asking questions about the sitcom, or the sitcom, the soap opera, The Bold and the Beautiful. Beautiful island footage, but that was about it. And then chapter three, him trying to get into shape, trying to get better health. He had a chemotherapy session, an allergist appointment due to an itch. I think the fact that this the fact that he's making a film based on diary entries, my guess, is trying to blur the line between art and life. It just didn't really – it didn't resonate with me. So, sorry. But, yeah, Caro Diario, available on Film Movement Classics from 1993. And then my daughter and I, after I made her watch Death of a Salesman, which is fair, I had her pick. And we did a triple feature on actual Labor Day. Juno, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and Chicken Run. That's a good trio to have with your 18-year-old daughter. She loves Juno, and I still do. And the Diablo Cody dialogue has not tired me. And J.K. Simmons is just one of the great cinematic dads, which is always a nice contrast after his Oscar-winning turn in Whiplash. So anyway, got to revisit that. Emma's also a big Allison Janney fan, as all of us are, to see her as Juno's stepmother. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, it has been years since I watched this, and I enjoyed the video game aspect of it, and still a lot of fun. And Chicken Run is our favorite Aardman film. So there you go. That's what we watched this week at home. You're listening to the Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Before I tell you to grab a pencil, let's go through what is happening around the state. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In, on screen one, you have Tenant. And on screen, movie two, on screen one is 42, Sky Point, the Chadwick Boseman. Screen two, you have Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets and Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Screen three, you have The New Mutants and Black Panther. Screen four, The Broken Hearts Gallery and A League of Their Own, all happening at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, wow, they got Peggy Sue Got Married, Better Off Dead, and Fast Times at Ridgemont High for you fans of the 80s. Over at IU Cinema, through September 16th, virtual, you have Days of the Whale, as well as Represent. Through September 23rd, Papicha. Tuesday, September 15th, a special virtual event at 7 o'clock, Apparition. Thursday, September 17th through Wednesday, September 30th, Made in Bangladesh. And Friday, September 18th, a special virtual event at 7 o'clock, Isabel Sandoval with a Q&A. And then Tuesday, September 22nd at 7 o'clock, the 1954 film of Animal Farm. So, and all that is happening over at IU Cinema. Over at the Can-Can, of course, cancanindie.com, Saturday, September 12th, favorite movie tunes with Monica Cantrell. I believe that is at Indie Fringe Pocket Park. Thursday, September 17th, Liberty and Justice for All, screening number two of I Am Not Your Negro. That is, you need reservations for that. Monday, September 21st, three stories, a Can-Can conversation series about sexual assault. Part one, discussion on the documentary The Hunting Ground at 7 o'clock on Monday, September 21st. Thursday, September 24th, Can-Can Outdoors, Paris is Burning. Wednesday, September 30th, Liberty and Justice for All, screening number 3 of 13th. And Thursday, October 6th, the part two discussion of conversation series about sexual assault at 7 o'clock of The Invisible War. Wednesday, October 7th, Can-Can Outdoors, Hunt for the Wilder People. Sorry. And Thursday, October 14th, Outdoors, Eraserhead. Man. Thursday, October 20th, part three of their conversation series about sexual assault at 7 o'clock, the film On the Record. And then Wednesday, October 21st, Outdoors, Get Out. Wednesday, October 28th, Outdoors, Shaun of the Dead. All of that happening at the Can-Can. Go to cancanindy.com for all your information. Just a reminder, Bardfest on Tour is happening September 12th at the Niedheimer Green Space in Indianapolis, September 19th at Indie Fringe, September 26th at Junk Ditch Playhouse in Fort Wayne, and October 3rd at Civic Park in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, where you can see William Shakespeare's long-lost first play. That's William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged. Sorry. All of that happening as part of Bardfest on Tour. You can go to indiebardfest.com for all the information there. And, of course, October 2nd through the 4th and 9th through the 11th at the Cat Theater in Carmel, the live radio production of Neil Simon's Plaza Suite. All right, grab a pencil, gang. Let's hear what you've been watching. We start with my buddy Eric, who has a first-time viewing of the 1940 farce I Love You Again, which he deemed good, starring William Powell and Myrna Loy, and his rewatch, the 1927 film The Lodger, A Story of the London Fog, which he deemed as good plus. So that is from my buddy Eric. Thank you, sir. Over on Twitter, we start with Jen of All Trades saying the original Mad Max, Django Unchained, Red Dragon, Silence of the Lambs, Practical Magic, and The Witches, to name a few. It was a four-day weekend. Ryan writes, The Endless. It was an incredible story and film. Neil writes, well, this was a conversation I had with Tracy Forner, who showed his youngins Galaxy Quest, and Neil chimed in, Galaxy Quest is a masterpiece. Lauren writes, I saw, and even after significant follow-up reading, did not totally understand Tenet. It was a double feature night where Space Jam was also screened, which had a much less complicated plot. Lauren also added, there was a Pulp Fiction reference in Space Jam that, of course, went over my head as a kid that had us losing it in the drive-in parking lot. It happens. Laya chimes in, The Tuskegee Airmen and Midnight Run. Jen of All Trades chimes in, I watched A Hateful Eight, but not this one. That's okay. Kelly writes, I made it 25 minutes in Uncut Gems before moving on. I really, really wanted to like it, but it was just not happening. Maybe I'll try again another time. Also to watch The Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons, simply because it was the right kind of escapism needed for that day. Surely Not Me writes, The Meyerowitz Stories, which I thought was quite good, and The Florida Project, which was kind of disappointing. I like Tangerine a lot more. I think that is it on Twitter. So thank you. There we go there. All right, going to Facebook. We start with Mike writing Tenet. Darren writing, I'm thinking of ending things. Welcome to Kutcher's Festival and Monterey Pop. Devin writes, Oliver and Company, Rocket Man, Dora and the Lost City of Gold, and David Foster off the record. Dylan writes, Convent 2000, Adrian Barbeau, Bill Moseley, and Coolio show up occasionally in a movie that features demon nuns and loads of fun practical effects. It just takes a while to get to the fun. Rachel writes, The Blob. I'm assuming that's the original. You never know. David writes, Super 8, The Other Guys, and Tenet. Michael writes, Blazing Saddles. Eric writes, The Galapagos Affair, Satan Came to Eden. Steve writes, Charlie Kaufman's latest film, I'm thinking of ending things, and I have questions like, what? it. Jody writes, Dumplin', literally a fantastic movie. Joe Shearer chimes in, if you enjoy Danielle McDonald in Dumplin', I wholeheartedly recommend her movie Patty Cakes. One of my favorite movies from 2 years ago. Think Hustle and Flow, but with her in the lead instead of Terrence Howard. And I also enjoyed Patty Cakes, Joe and Jody. George writes, finally watched The Irishman, great filmmaking. Tony writes, Tenet, Imitation of Life, 1959, and Raging Bull. Paula writes, all of the Bill and Ted's. Lori writes, Dune. Kirk writes, The Company Men and Margin Call. Ooh, there's a double feature. Taylor writes, Tread, good documentary of an obsessed man and a 5-ton bulldozer. The League of Gentlemen, good caper film. The original Ocean's 11, Loophole, Captain Marvel, and Fright Night, the remake, not as good or sexy as the original. I have to bring up Fright Night. I love Dr. Wes Gehring. He was my film genre professor at Ball State University, and we would do a different genre every week. And for horror, we did the original Fright Night. So he wanted to find the less obvious choices, and that one worked. The week, I think right before that, for science fiction fantasy, we watched Time After Time, which was a fine choice with Malcolm McDowell, Mary Steenburgen, and David Warner as Jack the Ripper. That's from 1979. Fright Night was 85, 86. Both films had disco scenes in it, one from the 70s, one from the 80s. So we made fun of him. He's a really good sport of giving us genre movies with disco scenes. Anyway, that's my Fright Night story. Also, the remake of Fright Night I saw in 3D, and it was the darkest. Is visual, not in tone. I don't know if it was the projectionist or the film itself, but it was at times hard to watch because it was so dark. Anyway, Mark writes, Casino Royale, the Daniel Craig Bond, actually improves on a second viewing, a pleasant surprise. Steven writes, Hitchcock's 1927 Silent the Lodger, immediately followed by the 1944 version with Laird Krieger, a very different take. Britt writes, Bombshell, DuckTales, 47 Meters Down, Jaws 3D, the 2019 Hellboy, all caps, terrible, 1917, and I Saw the Light. Cassandra writes, Knives Out, fabulous, Black Panther, amazing, and one other, can't remember what it was now. And yet you wrote that. Thank you. Melissa writes, Muppets Most Wanted and Karate Kid 1 and 2. Michelle writes, Mulan, I'm assuming the original, or the Disney Plus live action. Daniel writes, Tenet. Abby writes, Bella and Bill and Ted Face the Music. Devin writes, The 39 Steps from 1935, Henry V from 1944, Oliver Twist from 1949, The Beggar's Opera, 1953, The Prisoner of Second Avenue, and Chinese Coffee. Beverly writes the original Poltergeist. Jamie writes Thor Ragnarok, live-action Cinderella, Twitches, Zombies, and Zombies 2. Joni writes War Horse and Rocket Man. Lila writes, finally saw Marriage Story and liked it. Ran across Coming to America on TV and had to watch. Still funny. Shirley writes Marshall and Black Panther. Jeff writes, I'm thinking of ending things. Roxana writes, Mulan, love that my brother and my nieces share their Disney. Not saying that. Also binged Little Fires Everywhere. Wow. Andrea writes, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Daniel writes, I introduced my wife to Three Amigos last Friday. I think she did not like it. Nick writes, Project Power and Tenet, both deep into the Sopranos lately, so fewer movies. Leslie writes Constantine. Nancy writes Crossing Delancey and Birds of Prey. Heidi writes Strange But True, Netflix. Jesse writes Vibes, Kung Fury, and Hot Summer Nights. Joe writes Light Slate for me as well as various goings-on. Class Action Park, Color Out of Space, An American Pickle, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, Tenant, Love Guaranteed, that's the film my wife watched about the computer ding, and Random Acts of Violence. David writes Operation Endgame and A Fish Called Wanda. Diana writes Message from the King. Amy writes Philadelphia Story, Citizen Kane, The Tale of Princess Kaguya, and Seven Samurai. Dave writes Draft Day, Peeper, Bridget Jones's Diary, Money Monster, and Good Will Hunting. Emily writes McHale's Navy joins the Air Force. Oh my gosh. And Psych 2, Lassie Come Home. Patty writes Stardust, Rob Roy, The Highland Rogue, Disney, The Lady Vanishes, Return of the Jedi, and Robin Hood, the 1973 Disney version. Connor writes The Death of Stalin, Into the Spider-Verse, and Zombieverse. Jed writes, just watched Giles Anderson's film The Dare. What a great horror film, full of twists and turns and a creepiest ending I've seen this year. Thomas writes The Odyssey from 2016. Joe writes Netflix's Cobra Kai, Mary Queen of Scots, the Katharine Hepburn version, and the more recent one, with and as well as BBC's Elizabeth R. by Glenda Jackson. Gary writes Tenet, Unhinged, John Wick, 1, 2, and 3. Grace writes The Old Guard. If all action movies were like this, I'd watch so many more of them. Annie writes what Patty said. Thank you, buddy. Johnny Iguana, one of my buddies and musician friends. I tried watching The King of Comedy with my 12-year-old, but his first day of school was the next day, and he got upset at how disturbing and depressing he found it. I was surprised how deeply it stuck with him that way. So we stopped it and put in A Mighty Wind instead, which received a much better response. Johnny, I get it. The King of Comedy is 1983, and I think it's just as relevant today, more so maybe, than it was back then. A great look at fame, and I think it's criminally underappreciated, especially in the Scorsese canon. So try again in a few years, or try Face in the Crowd if you haven't already. Mary writes The Uninvited and The Changeling. Terry writes Bonjour Tristy, as well as Blonde Crazy. Doug writes Richard Jewell, Call of the Flesh, Fiesta, and A Raisin in the Sun. Helen writes the film version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Our current show, and she also said our current show is Mrs. America. Andra Faye writes, currently watching Grisham, The Firm, and The Rainmaker last weekend. Craig writes, Joker, Sorry We Miss You, and The Kiss of Death, the Mike Lee film. Not the... Anyway, Catherine writes The Gentleman, Little Women, Game Night, and 1917. Michonne writes Bill and Ted Face the Music. I found it most excellent. Lou writes Passengers and The Angels Sing, Star Spangled Rhythm, and I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Robert Muggy writes obscure pre-code Joan Blondell films on the Criterion Channel. Jeff writes Rocket Man, a rewatch, The Fabulous Alan Carr, the documentary, and the 1955 version of Picnic. How you doing there, Jeff? Kelly writes Blazing Saddles, again, Frenzy, again, The Sting, again, and Gerald's Game. Richard writes Spider-Man, Homecoming, and Avengers Affinity Wars, clearly taking a break from reality. Jules writes He Got Game. Kim writes, I always get so excited when I can report I watched a movie. It's been nearly 6 weeks. Watched Just Right the other night because I love Queen Latifah and Common. Cheers. Thank you, Kim. Mason writes, Rashomon and La Ventura. Spencer writes, Midsummer, eerie but not scary. Ford versus Ferrari, much better than I had expected. And It Happened One Night surprisingly holds up. The swift-paced banter makes it so so younger audiences today. Let me read that again. It Happened One Night surprisingly holds up. The swift-paced banter makes it so younger audiences today could likely watch and keep interested. Jay writes, Dave Built a Maze was trippy and fun. Linda writes, Emma again, loved it. Janet writes, American Hustle, The Descendants, The Bank Job, In Bruges, Stand Up Guys, Best of Enemies, The Fighter, and Patriots Day. Ben writes Dodgeball. Nicole writes Muppet Treasure Island. I have no idea how I survived this long without seeing it. It happens, Nicole. At least you saw Iga. Joe writes City Slickers. And finally, Melissa writes Love Guaranteed. And there you go. That's what you've been watching this week, friends. Same here. So again, I hope you're, I say this every week, I hope you're watching films that are new or new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. So friends, here's some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. We're going to end this week's Film Sociology with an audio tribute to actress Dame Diana Rigg. Looking back at her career, this kind of hit hard in my little world, in my little pop culture world. Because, well, for a lot of people's pop culture world. But a classically trained actress who made a mark in film, television, and the stage. Beautiful and sexy as hell. And a bit of a badass because of the Avengers, because of her performance as Emma Peel. She won a Tony for Madea, of course, and received nominations for shows like The Misanthrope. Going back through her career, of course, the Avengers for a couple of years she was on that. I'm hopefully going to revisit the 1968 film version of A Midsummer Night's Dream, where she's playing Helena opposite Helen Mirren's Hermia. The Assassination Bureau, of course, with Oliver Reed. And her other pop culture iconship is she's Mrs. James Bond. She's Tracy on Her Majesty's Secret Service, an underappreciated Bond film. Portia in the 1970 film version of Julius Caesar, The Hospital, Theater of Blood. She's fun in Theater of Blood, and she keeps up with Vincent Price chewing scenery and doing Shakespeare. Never forget, she had an American sitcom for a season called Diana. She was Charlotte in A Little Night's Music, Lady Holiday in The Great Muppet Caper, which I know that's Ashley's favorite, Evil Under the Sun. She was Regan in the Laurence Olivier TV film version of King Lear, Good Man in Africa, Mrs. Danvers in the 90s version of Rebecca. Of course, she was a longtime host of Mystery after Vincent Price, The Painted Veil. She did Doctor Who, and of course, that Game of Thrones thing. So, but yeah. And from what I've heard, just a great lady, and I've not heard a bad story. I did read one thing, I don't know if it's true or not, where when the Avengers was going, her mother would answer a lot of her fan mail, and if she got hot letters from teenage boys, she would tell the young man, "You're too young for my daughter. You should go take a walk or a run." So, anyway, besides the fact that Mrs. Peel launched a millions of men and women with a costume fetish, but yeah, butt kicking females, that's a favorite. So, but all of those dynamics, thank you, Diana Rigg, and we end today's show with the song from on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Here's Louis Armstrong. We have all the time in the world. Anyway, until next time, take care, everybody. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. Thanks, Diana.
We have all the time in the world, time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more. Every step.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!